Welcome to another edition of Shedding Lights, a little bit after 1 o'clock, here on the 29th day of December of 2009. And I'm joined today by I'm honored to have these guests in the studio today. This is going to be a show about, the next 2 hours are going to be about prison. This hour, with live guests in the studio, talking about their experience in the system and what they're doing now. And the second hour of this two-hour excursion will be a radio show we've called off the internet, where prisoners are calling in and wishing holiday greetings to their loved ones. And that'll be at 2 o'clock, 2 to 3, with Raising Sand. Anyway, I'm joined today by Henrietta Burrows of East Palo Alto Today, the newspaper. She's the editor-in-chief and publisher of that paper. Henrietta, welcome back to KZSU Shedding Light.
Thank you so much, Bird. It's just a delight, as always, to be here with you.
Thank you. And we're also joined by David Lewis, a former prisoner that was in the California penal system. David, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And get a little closer on that mic when you do talk. And we're also joined by someone I've heard, but I've never met, but Malik Rahim wanted me to meet you, and I'm glad we're finally meeting. Dorsey Nunn. And Dorsey, you're involved with Legal Services and an organization called All of Us or None.
Yeah, Legal Services for Prisoners with Children.
Okay.
And All of Us or None.
Okay. You know what, Dorsey? We're going to have to switch mics on you, and that'll be no problem at all.
This one here?
No, the white one, the one with the white on it. The other, Kathy, that white one. Get that one. Okay, we got it. Dorsey, there you go.
Yeah, how's this?
No, doesn't seem like it's happening.
How about now?
Okay, there you go. Now we're on. Good. And we on the phone. We also have Tandria Madison. And Tandria, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Welcome to KZSU. Now, Henrietta, you brought these guests on. Why don't you go ahead and let us know what you were thinking of today.
Well, I brought the guests on because we have featured them separately in several articles. We featured them together in issues about the prison system and the impact of parolees being in East Palo Alto, California. It just so happens that a federal judge or state judge ordered that 40,000 prisoners be released from California state prisons over the next 2 years. And with that amount of prisoners being released, the impact might be enormous throughout the state and in communities where they might return. And so we think it's very important to deal with some of these issues now. Some people would say, oh, the prisoners are in prison, let's close the door and keep them locked up. But that's not going to happen. So what can communities do to prepare for the parolees who are already among them and for more parolees that might be released from prison?
And does the prison system release parolees into neighborhoods knowing that there might be a problem? And is there a thing going on there? Does the prison system use parole as a weapon against the community? Has that ever been discovered?
Well, we have some guests here who could answer that question far better than I. So, David, you work with parolees, and Dorsey, you work in the prison system with prisoners just like David, and Tandria, who's on the telephone, can give some insight into that particular question, Bird.
David, why don't you start?
That's the first time I ever heard of it like that. My concept is that people get released into communities that they actually committed crimes in and got arrested in.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of listening to some of the earlier comments, and communities being able to stand up and take it upon themselves and understanding that the system, the correctional system, is not really the people that we need to be looking towards to structure, organize, and convene the people that's coming back into our communities. I think that's a community effort. I think, I don't know, last count that I heard is like you got 650,000 people that get released from jails and prisons a year in this country to communities like East Palo Alto and East L.A. and East St. Louis, the east side of New York and all them east places. And this has been going on for years. So how do we as a community rise up and say that we're going to construct a system within our communities to be able to deal with people coming to our communities from prisons?
I think the issue, too, is why should people care?
Well, you know, and I'm going to say this, is I just take East Palo Alto for instance. It's like we 2.5 by 2.5 square miles. 50,000 people at now. I came there in 1959, and I'm in full disclosure, I have 4 children by 4 different women, and each of those women have 4 children by 4 different men. We all kin to each other. That's why we should care.
So, what concerns should those in the community and in surrounding communities, what concerns should they have that more prisoners are being released into the community?
One of the concerns, that this is Dorsey representing all of us, Anon, and being that we didn't already had the Stanford disclaimer, then maybe we can get down to some raw honesty and I can represent me.
Please do.
Because I really do have an opinion. Why you should care? Because they didn't already punished, abused, and locked so many of us up that it impacts the community whether you want it or not. You know, so we can talk about, you know, whether or not David can provide a few jobs. But there's the reality of it is there's so many people that have been convicted of crimes and being stigmatized by the state that it's impossible to throw 3 coins in the middle of East Palo Alto without hitting one of us. Mm-hmm. You know, so the reality of it is we can talk about jobs or we can talk about the denial to real stuff like housing, a dial to an economy, because there's so few jobs and there's so many of us. We're not having a conversation no longer about what you do for Dorsey. Just do it for yourselves. Just have a conversation about what would Henrietta want to look, what East Palo Alto look like, and what would be best for Henrietta. And if we have that conversation, sooner or later we have a conversation about what's best for all of us.
Okay, let's have that conversation.
Yeah, I think we're right there.
Yes, exactly. Given the economic slowdown, there are a lot of people who
all
would
right.
be concerned.
So, yeah, you should be concerned. If they're going to spend $46,000 a year housing one of us and deny us access to adequate things in the middle of the community, you should be concerned about $46,000 being multiplied by $170,000. You would be really stupid not to be concerned about the dropping of that type of loot. You'd be concerned about billions of dollars, I believe it was $10 billion, spent in the state of California on the prison system while you're denying equal opportunity to people in East Palo Alto. So you should really be concerned about how do we manage our economy and how do we manage people in East Palo Alto. We should just be frightened to death. So let's start deconstructing this boogeyman.
Wait.
And let's get Tandria Madison on. Tandria?
Before we start deconstructing the boogeyman, let's back it up a little bit. You know, there was a question about, well, there's a concern that there are these 40,000 prisoners that are being released. And although I couldn't hear David, I want to say this. All 40,000 of them ain't coming to East Palo Alto. They're not all going to be released into San Mateo County. That's 40,000 prisoners that are being released throughout the entire state of California. And I got to honestly tell you, that's not making much of a dent. Especially when you look at how overcrowded the prisons and the jails are throughout the state. 40,000 really isn't that big of a deal.
It's not that big of a deal for the prison system, but it might be that big of a deal for the communities to whom they're being released.
Right, but you look at the fact that we're talking about 40,000 that are throughout the state. There isn't a county in the state that's going to end up with all 40,000 prisoners.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And I was thinking, I was reading someplace.
Let's think about who those 40,000 is. Because, like, when we talk about 40,000 people be released, of that population, those people were going to be coming home within the next 2 years anyway. And we're talking about
stretched out over 2 years.
And we're talking about elderly, frail people with less than 2 years to serve. So we're not talking about releasing Charlie Manson, and we're not talking about releasing Richard Allen Davies. We're talking about 40 people probably on canes and walkers that need to be released, that probably should have been released years ago, that we somehow forestalled the reality. So if the community is going
to
be concerned,
no
threats to begin with, and not only are we talking about that group of people, we're talking about a class of people that we spend in between $70,000 and $160,000 to house them a year because they have medical needs. So when we talk about that group of people, when I say deconstruct the boogeyman, sometimes out of fear or ignorance, people do crazy stuff like expend resources that we don't have to spend on this population of people. And at the same time, you know, like I hadn't been afraid before. And when I was afraid, I became the most dangerous person that you wanted to meet. So sometimes society can get into this, the framework of fear, and move towards fear as opposed to move towards hope or progress. And as a result of moving towards fear, they don't recognize that they injure the community in a real particular way.
Let's talk about moving towards progress. And let's talk about perhaps what we should be looking at, what the priorities should be. And if we are concerned, where do we start in terms of dealing with what the real issues are?
For me, where that needs to start is that, one, the fear-mongering that's happening around this issue needs to stop. These people that are coming home to these communities are coming home. They left these communities. So see, these are some of the same people that were there before, that lived in your communities for years, peacefully, law-abiding. So that's something to keep in mind. These aren't the big bad boogeyman that's coming home.
Now, Tandria, you know, somebody would say if they lived peacefully in the community and they were law-abiding, how did they get locked up in the first place?
Because some of these people that you have locked up may have been people that were victims of three strikes that really, they didn't go to jail for murder. They perhaps went to jail for petty theft. Maybe it was somebody who ended up on a parole violation, a mother who was out trying to do something for her kids and got locked up because of that. You know, there's a lot of reasons that people end up in jail, and, you know, keeping it 100 and being real honest about it, everybody doesn't get locked up because of something that they've done that's heinously wrong. I mean, my mom ended up with felonies, but her felonies were they were misdemeanors. It was petty theft. That's a misdemeanor. It then becomes a felony when it's petty theft with a prior. My mom is out there still in clothes for me. But now she's in jail for felonies, doing big time, because she's out there trying to provide for me. So why would you have a problem with her coming back to the community? If you put somebody in a rock in a hard place and you put them in a position where they're not able to pursue an education, where they're not able to get a job, where they're not able to get housing, where they can't do the things that they need to provide for themselves or their families, what other choices do they have when you take everything else away?
Well, the concern is that people will be coming back, and their job opportunities aren't going to be any greater. Their housing opportunities aren't going to be that good either. So what are the options, and what can society begin to do now?
And that's where the community comes in. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sitting here listening to Tandria, that's your name?
Tandria.
Yeah.
Tandria. And it's like almost a brush of fresh air. I'm old. Dorsey's a little older than me, but and we've been fighting this fight.
23 years old.
We've been fighting this fight for a long
you
time.
Miss out my opportunities because you want to be old.
You know, I guess for me, it's just, you know, it's delightful just to hear you talking this way. I look at it like this here. You ask what needs to happen, what needs to be provided. First of all, is that voice that this young woman has here needs to be there. It needs to be in the forefront. They had, when I was coming up in the 60s, they talked about cigarette smoke and cancer and nicotine and all that kind of stuff, and it killed thousands of people a year, millions of people a year, whatever. And nobody really did nothing about it. Yeah, okay, those people smoking, and they got it coming, whatever. It wasn't until secondhand smoke came along that was killing people that was presumably innocent of smoking cigarettes that we actually got some stuff going, some legislation, some laws, all of that kind of stuff. And this young woman, to me, represents secondhand smoke. People will more likely to listen to her than they will to me. It's just like Dorsey said that take away the boogeyman. It's like I went to prison for selling $20 worth of heroin to an undercover narcotic agent. That was 30-some years ago. Today, that same crime would get you a slap on the wrist, would get you some probation or something like that. So now we're in a situation where we're talking about the same person that possibly could have got diverted, that possibly could have got some services in the community, substance abuse treatment or what have you. And instead of that, what we're doing is we're loading our prison system up with these folks. And it's not until that voice that Tandra has to be able to revolutionize the community to say, this is my damn mama that you're talking about sending away, that I think there's something going to happen.
How about this? My mama, not parolee. Because, like at a certain point.
Make it personal. Yeah.
If you make it personal and start speaking to people, as opposed to the ex-convict, the parolee, and start describing the problem as such that these people are somehow different from the rest of us, the people who are coming back to our community are our family members.
So, well, Dorsey, people weren't that concerned, I don't think, about the fact this was your mama before she went to jail. So how is it now people are going to be concerned that this is your mama,
you know,
when she comes out?
Hold it. My whole problem is that they may not be concerned. And that's how come I'm saying, all right, let's shift it to what would you want to have happen in your best interest? So I assume that what you'd want to have happen is that the money that we are dropping in a wasteful manner stop. You know, point blank. I would assume that what you would want to happen, being that I'm a formerly incarcerated person, that I would be employable, have a job, and pay taxes too. I assume that what you would want to happen, instead of the house that I live in being foreclosed on, that you want me to continue to pay for that stuff. So some of the stuff that we need to stop is an ugly private practice that we're going to start putting into public policy, like structural discrimination. So one of the things that we can do is make sure that people have an equal opportunity at employment questions. Then in addition to having an equal opportunity at employment questions, maybe we can actually question the validity of a number of background searches that many people do that are illegal.
Okay, let's start with the unemployment, the application, what needs to change.
How about that question on the application, have you ever been convicted of a felony?
Or misdemeanor,
or have you ever been incarcerated? And when you get to places like, being that you said this program is national, when you get to places like North Carolina, the question is, have you ever been arrested? And that be the basis in which you deny employment, you deny housing opportunities, you deny educational opportunities. Right there, you are already constructing a boogeyman or a second-class citizen.
Should employers know whether somebody they're about to hire, whether
yes,
that person has been arrested,
what's that,
convicted?
What's
yes,
that?
But when it's relevant. There comes a point where that question is relevant, and then there comes a point where it's not. And what we ask is not that it be the first question that you ask. That question is on applications for financial aid, for housing, for almost everything that you can think of. And in California, if you've
ever
been
convicted. How about life insurance?
You know, in California, if you've ever been convicted of a drug felony, you have a lifetime ban on housing. If you've ever been convicted of any kind of felony, you are automatically disqualified from being able to get any financial assistance from the state, Pell Grants, Cal Grants, anything, and that's permanent. That's ever. How is anybody going to be able to come home and try to pursue education or get a place to live, a roof over their head, if they're banned from that? And there's another rule that if you have family that's in housing and you come home and you stay with them and housing finds out that that person is on parole, your family loses housing as well.
Is the system broken?
The system is broken. Man, are you kidding? The system's in so many pieces you can't even count them.
How do we change it?
How do we fix it?
I realize the system is huge and trying to take on the system is a huge task. For me, I believe in starting at smaller places. I believe in starting in the community. All of Us or None has a Ban the Box campaign, and that's what that campaign is about, is dealing with that question on applications. But I believe in first taking out the fear and the stigma that happens with communities where they freak out when somebody is coming home. You know, this number 40,000, people aren't thinking about this on a statewide level, which is why I made that comment in the first place. They're thinking, oh, these 40,000 are, one, going to be released all at one time, and they're not. It's over a two-year period. And two, they're all going to come here. No, they're not all going to come here. And three, there are these heinous murderers and these people that have committed these ridiculous crimes. That's not true either. Mm-hmm. So it's about dispelling those myths and getting the truth to the people who need to hear it. These people are not coming home trying to kill you and your kids and bury you somewhere. These are people that are coming home and trying to make a life for themselves, whatever lives they have left, for the elder prisoners that are coming home and for the younger ones that are coming home. They just want to come home and be with their families. They want the same rights that you and I have here at home, to be able to come home to work, to provide for their families, to have freedom, to not continue to be harassed. Because I can't tell you how many people serve their sentences. They go to jail, they do parole and probation, they pay restitution, but they are still continuing to pay for their crimes. My mom has been clean for going on 16 years, and she still cannot get permission to go into prisons to speak to them to help. And if there's anybody whose voice needs to be heard in a prison, it's a former prisoner. She fought it all the way to the governor and was denied. My mother has worked at the same job for more than 10 years, owns a home, has paid off cars, has done everything she's supposed to do, pays her taxes, is law-abiding. Why
now, Tandria, if your mother could do all of those things after her release, and those questions, that question is still on the application, what's going to stop these other released prisoners, parolees, from doing what your mother has done?
How about the perception? How about the perception that they shouldn't try because you're going to have a system in place that will stop
them. They're going to keep slamming doors.
And suppose Tandria Mama is the exception in what we done put into place.
And what we done put into place is
the structural discrimination that exists that stops hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. You getting ready to hold this time around a census. In the census taking in this country, what you doing for the first time this time is prohibiting people who have been convicted of felonies from even counting our own people.
Really?
So, like, when we get down to this question, what we're going to do is almost like David could be David, formerly incarcerated person. David is also a phlebotomist, that people want to take away license of people like David, that will never, you could never educate people to look for what David knows in his head to be true. David would go into crack houses and actually test people, their blood. Now, you could probably have Stanford Institution educating phlebotomists, but I doubt if they know where to find people who's most need of testing. You know, and I doubt if the people who are taking census will know or have the ability to actually count people when they haven't experienced that lifestyle.
We can talk about the things that are wrong. So let's start right now in what can we do to bring changes? What can we do to bring changes in terms of the application? What can we do to bring changes in terms of the housing discrimination?
All right.
For those things have to happen on a community level. You know, the community has to push for that change if that's what they want. And they have to be speaking to their elected officials and representatives, up to state legislators, all the way up to the top, to Congress. You know, if they want that box removed from the applications, they have to push for that, because the legislators certainly aren't going to come to them with it.
What is your organization doing?
They have to push for that. They have
Henrietta, I can get more local, because I think that, you know, if we start local, maybe we can go national. All right?
Right.
So if we go local, things that people in East Palo Alto can do. When somebody come in and asks to build housing or to build companies, make sure that the people who are going to be actually doing the building actually probably live in East Palo Alto. And if not live in East Palo Alto, make sure that they don't run into the structural discrimination that they run into while trying to be employed while living in East Palo Alto. In the event that you get into a housing situation and we're going to actually make conditions favorable for people building housing, Let's make sure that when they put out an application, what they put on the application will mean that people who are currently living in East Palo Alto can still live in East Palo Alto after they actually build the building and actually represent some parts of that. So, like, some things that we can actually depend on is what type of policies do we put into effect in East Palo Alto and other places. In the event that people are coming home from prison, let's actually create other models in East Palo Alto that actually will allow people to enter and have services available to them, and consider that the services that we're providing for them is not something that we're doing specially for those people. Let's look at it as these are services that we're providing for our family members and our neighbors who are returning to their homes. So
maybe, that includes job training and skill training and substance and abuse counseling, and, you know, that people are able to come home and get, you know, skills that are actually usable in the market, from building resumes to typing to learning the things that they need to pick up a skill or a trade, especially because those things are now being cut in the prison.
All right. You and know, if they weren't. Hang on, Dave, I don't
want to
step all over
you. One of the things, I teach cognitive psychology, and in a lot of arenas that I go into with my background, they will look at me as an exception. And Tandra said her mother was an exception, is not the rule. Years ago, I was doing some work with, I'm not going to mention the name of it, but it was a railroad company. And this was years ago when I first got into this stuff. I just got out of prison and stuff. And what I realized is that they had no women at that particular time that was driving the train. And then all of a sudden, they had a young woman that came up through the ranks and became an engineer. And everybody labeled her as an exception. Then another one came. Then another one came. And the exception became the norm. Communities like East Palo Alto, East Menlo Park, East whatever, need to understand that cognitive psychology approach and create more and more and more exceptions. See, I've been out of prison 20 years, and they had a group of people that took me and provided all of these exceptional services for me, and that's what became how I became to be the exception. I'm pretty sure, just like Tandra's mother, it's like there were some people. If Tandra, if you can look back on her transition, there probably were some people that provide, along with herself, that provided some exceptional stuff. And as long as we continue to look at one exception and say, well, that's the exception, there's no more, we're going to continue to have the Dorsey Nuns, the David Lewis's, and this few sprinkle people out there, instead of the community getting behind creating the exception so it become the norm.
Part of what it was for my mom was definitely an employment break. Because she went through plenty of interviews where, you know, she would get in for the interview, but then, you know, once they got to that question, they basically didn't want to hear anymore, and she didn't get the job. Mm-hmm. And she went through a lot of those. She went through a lot of applications and submitting her resume, where she was quite qualified, but never got a call back because of that question, mm-hmm. asking if she'd ever been convicted of a felony. And so she finally, you know, how she got around answering that question, because it's a catch-22. You can either say no, and then at any point, if they pull a background check, you're terminated immediately because you lied on your application, or you can say yes and never get the interview in the first place. Mm-hmm. So what she started doing was writing on that question we'll discuss in the interview. And sometimes people just took it as a yes, and other times people allowed her to come in for the interview and spoke to her. And what she ended up getting was an employer who was like, you know what, basically, we'll give you a chance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She's been at her job for more than 10 years.
And that doesn't happen to most people.
It doesn't, you know, and that's why it was the exception. But it was what she needed,
yeah.
You know. But you get to a point where, as a provider, you get desperate. You have to have a way to make money.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have income, you can't provide food, clothing, housing. It's the bottom of everything. But if you don't have that coming in, but you have people that are leaning on you, particularly when it comes to children, it just puts you in a rock and a hard place. And that's for the people who don't end up losing their kids in the system when they get locked up in the first place.
That's the voice of Tandria Madison. We're joined also with David Lewis, Dorsey Nunn, and the editor-in-chief of East Palo Alto Today, Henrietta Burrows. This is another edition of Shedding Light on KZSU. And today we're talking about people leaving the prison system and coming back into the community, and how that system might not be completely all it could be.
Hey, Henrietta, one of the things that we just did in December, which was a community give back, that was organized by formerly incarcerated people. And every December, we give away hundreds of bikes to a poor, struggling community. And this thing is being spearheaded, orchestrated, and the funds are being raised by formerly incarcerated people to go into places like East Palo Alto, West Oakland, in Richmond to give toys back to kids. At no point do we ever see the media show up and cover us, but you know they will cover every sorry minute we have as a parolee, but never they don't cover our weddings, they don't cover our funerals, they cover just the stuff that sells the press. In the most part, when we collecting bicycles and we put our money in to actually serve the community in a real way, that's one instance in where we serve in the community. And that's just a real short-sighted vision. I already recognize that people will live up or down to expectations. So we have the ability to come back if they really want to allow us in and do something with the foreclosed property in East Palo Alto and reconstruct that and actually make sales. So if you got into Dorsey the communist, I would start talking about let's seize foreclosed property so we can actually give them back to people in the community that need places to stay and get out of winter weather, and we can actually fix that stuff up ourselves, or at least not fix it up for ourselves, fix it up so we can sell it and pay the people fixing it up so they have a job is a longer vision to have. So when you talk about what can we do, there is so much that we can do, but we are limited by assuming that people like me and Dave are still the boogeyman.
Mm-hmm. You started that statement with the media never shows up.
Yeah.
Can the community, now Henrietta has started a paper in East Palo Alto, first black paper in East Palo Alto in 20 years, right, Henrietta?
Well, we could call it the first multicultural paper.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. See, but I'm still not scared of being black. You can talk to me, dog. I won't claim anything but that. You know what I'm saying? We ain't even got to get there. I ain't even got to soft shoe this. I can say that when we talk about incarceration in the state of California, incarceration in West Coast, we can talk about the reinvention of the second Jim Crow. We can talk about putting all of our resources as a civil rights movement into fighting the Bakke decision when somebody had another plan that said as a result of a conviction of felonies and misdemeanor, we can still deny the same group of people the equal opportunity that we should have gave them when we first brought them here. So, but anyway, I'm not going to soft shoe who we locking up and what we locking up. And I can say that, you know, your fear will allow us to use the fear as an instrument of torture, not claim it. So, like, let's own what we do. We can use it as a model of revenge, or we can use it as a model of justice. And what we currently use it as a model of revenge. So let's call it for what it is. It's a model of revenge that
Dorsey Nunn right there. Dorsey Nunn telling us how he really feels. But back to this media thing now. Henrietta has acquired her own cable access TV show in the community. And I'm thinking, have you had David?
I've had David on. I've had Dorsey Nunn on.
Okay. And can the community help that problem about the media never showing up?
Yeah. Yes, the community can help.
And would that help?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, that one, this year, because I'm the media person for LSPC, for Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, and so, which is the parent of All of Us or None. And so, you know, every year when we're gearing up for the Give Back, because, of course, it's huge for us, and our entire organization participates in it, we reach out to the media. And I will say that over the years, there has been some help. KMEL has been great, and not this year, but last year in 2008, they actually collected toys on our behalf at the studio before the Give Back. They, you know, collected different gifts and stuff, and so a few days before the Give Back, we were able to go by the studio to pick those toys up, you know, from people in the community who were giving. So, you know, there has been a little bit of support, but, you know, compared to the coverage that happens to other things, like we had the give back on the 12th. Just a few days later, Contra Costa County firemen gave, I think, yeah, 300 or 400 bikes, you know, bikes for Tykes, and they got this huge coverage. And it's like, okay, but we just gave away over 180 bikes, and we got nothing. So, you know,
but
I mean, not even honorable mention, but the community can help by getting in touch with their media outlets themselves and going, hey, we have this going on, so that it's not just coming from us going, hey, we need to support the community, going, we want you to cover this.
Well, let me just say here, that's why East Palo Alto Today, the newspaper, exists, to give people the type of information, the type of coverage that they will not get from mainstream media. And it's a focus on the community that does not focus on what's sensational. It doesn't focus on the murders. It doesn't focus on whatever the concept, if it bleeds, it leads. It focuses on the type of activities that All or None is involved in. It focuses on the very positive things that are going on in an attempt to give people, not only within the community, but outside of the community, another type of insight and approach to some of the issues.
I can't, you know what, Henrietta, I just need to say this on air nationally and all that stuff. I really appreciate your newspaper. I mean, because you're saying exactly. I was telling Dorsey earlier, I said, Henrietta just calls out of the clear blue and says, I need you to come be on television, the radio,
and I'm on
whatever. Yeah. And it's like, why? And I mean, we out here and they have to fight the construction that's going on. And I said, why do I come? And I said, well, because Henrietta
called us.
Whatever our views are, Henrietta is able to put it in print. You know, the other thing, Tandra, I don't know how long you've been with the organization, but the other thing that needs to be told is how that giveaway even started, because there's always this disconnect between inside and outside. A guy told me in Redmond, Oregon one day, he said, David, he's a businessman. He's listening to me present, and he said, you know, it sounds like what happens in this situation, this justice, criminal justice thing, is that you build a half-mile bridge across a mile river. And see, the outside doesn't know, the media doesn't know that there's some things that's going on inside the institutions, like the same institution that you know that if your mother got the opportunity to go into that could enhance those things. But that giveaway started from within San Quentin, a bunch of prisoners. A bunch of prisoners saying, you know what, we're in here reconstructing bicycles and we want them to go to our communities. And they has had a correctional official at that time that allowed it to happen, and it mushroomed into this thing. That makes sense to you? So if the story be told, to be able to say that it's not just us formerly incarcerated people, because like Dorsey is saying, on any given day it could be either one of us. You know, it's not like we that far out of the fire. I've been out 20 years, you've been out 25 years or something like that. But on any given day, because of the restraints, because of the lifetime conviction of having a felony, it can be any given day that we'll be on the inside.
And when they gave us the bikes out of San Quentin wanted us to go into our communities and says, San Quentin gave you these bicycles.
Exactly.
Right? And what I stood up and told to kids over there in Acorn Projects, which was the first place we did it, was that your parents sent you these bicycles. The kids needed to know that their parents loved them. They didn't need to know that San Quentin loved them. It was a need in the community. And we needed to have a mechanism where we start counting who's missing in the community. Because there's a lot of people that are missing in the community for extended periods of time, for little or nothing, and but yet we keep looking at Charlie Manson as the model, as opposed to our homeboy Dundee that got caught with $10 worth of something and got 25 years to life.
Let's talk about the perspective within the community, because there are those within the community who will say, well, there are these positive programs for prisoners, formerly incarcerated prisoners, parolees, and they should have programs out here for us. So how do you deal with that perspective within the community that would resent the positive things right now being done for parolees?
One of the things that I would point out is maybe if we change the framework about how they look at that group of people and stop looking at them separate from themselves, then maybe they can accept the services as being needed for everybody.
How do you do that, though?
You know, by first having a conversation about these people that are coming home to the community or our neighbors. You know, these people coming home from our community is a person first and not some other category that we dislike. So some parts of it is how do we frame that particular issue to talk about that subject matter. And by the way, Henrietta, I do really appreciate the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the other part of it, too, because I can remember going on your television program. And what we talked about is us accessing the rights to vote. And what I'm saying to you, that it's possible for us to sustain a consistent attack without having a more detrimental impact to you than anything else in your lifetime. So if me, David, and a whole bunch of us don't work in our communities, it actually make the whole community poor. So stop looking at it as if it's us separate from the community. This is an attack on the community, that the community have accepted the framework that is only a segment of the community. There was, during the course of slavery, there wasn't everybody that was a slave. They had free black people, too. Hmm. You know? So, like, that exceptional rule, the free black people. The common rule, slaves. So, like,
the community has to start understanding that people that are coming home from jails and prisons are still people. They're still human beings. They still have rights, you know, in our minds, and because of the way that things are presented to us, it's an us and them. Mm-hmm. But that's not true. There is no us and them. There's all of us.
Or
and
not.
So people have to start.
Kind of like the Willie Lynch syndrome. You know, when you look at communities like ours, and I see this across the country, and you look at the economical situation and the haves and the have-nots, and we live in this country, in the most greediest time in the history of the world, and instant gratification, and I want mine, and so we pit brother against brother and all of that kind of stuff, and the almighty dollar is the one. So it's very, very easy to look at people from your community and then use that whole thing as the country decides what this person is, the demonizing of this person, to say, oh, yeah, see, that's the person that got my job at Caltrans on the freeway versus me, and I got a college degree. That makes sense to you? So we need to start really, really having that conversation about the economical situation that we find ourselves in our community. You know, in East Palo Alto, we got a parolee program, and it's a collaboration between our community and Caltrans and all those folks, right? So a parolee can actually come out of prison and go through a couple-week process and then start working at Caltrans, making only $10 an hour. I just need to say this, $10 an hour. I get more calls from people saying, why them and why not me? That makes sense to you?
Yes, it does.
And I don't really know how to answer the question until we start to address some of the stuff that Dorsey's talked, the whole economical situation in our city.
But, you know, here's the flip side to that is, you know, parolees can look at that and go, okay, but you have access to this and this and this, and I don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's like, I mean, there's always a why them and not me situation, and that's where the delineation has to stop. You know, you want people that are coming home to have some resources. Otherwise, the recidivism just gets ridiculous and the cycle just continues.
Yes, but those people who would hear, you have this, this, and this, and I don't, that person would say, well, if I had it, I would go out and get that job myself. That I don't have access or I can't get it. And I'm living here trying to do what's right. And here somebody is formerly incarcerated, comes
right
out, and they get it automatically.
Hey,
but see, they don't. And that's the thing. You know, it's like, and it's all a matter of perception, and it's all in the way that it's presented. You know, there are people that come home that face challenges that people that have never been in prison don't know anything about. There are problems that they have to face from the minute they touch down. You know, they're giving them what, Dorothy, is it $200 gate money? What is $200 going to do? I can blow through $200 in 30 minutes.
Right.
We won't ask you what you've been doing.
You know, it's like you coming home. I mean, how are you? You know, you're coming home with $200 in your pocket. If you got family that's in housing, you can't go stay with them because you're jeopardizing that. So you got to figure out somewhere to stay. You got to figure out a way to get some clothes because, of course, you only got the clothes that you got locked up in or that got sent to you while you were gone so that you could come home in them. So you got those clothes. And then you got to figure out how you're going to eat. I don't know anybody who's going to be able to stretch that beyond like maybe a week, and that's if they're real, real, real lucky.
Can the community help with that? Can there be something in place?
You know, like
yes, and that's you know that's where you know like transitional housing come in, or a halfway house that allows people to be able to come home and at least you know stay for like maybe 4 to 6 weeks to allow them to get on their feet, so that they have an address, so that when they apply for jobs, they're not going from pillar to post. You know, or for people that are coming home and they're struggling with addiction, for them to be able to go into substance abuse places where basically they can get stable and they get the support that they need. And to be honest, that's really what it comes down to, is support. When you get doors slamming in your face constantly, you're already coming into a situation where you're trying to recover. You're coming in with strikes against you, you know, because people already think negatively of you. Well, they did this and this, so they're no good. So, you know, you're already having to fight that stigma to begin with, and then you're dealing with the reality of your life. And that's for people that don't have any children when they come home. For the ones that got kids.
Henrietta, one of the things that you raised, your initial framing of this question was, what about the people who are currently suffering in an extreme economic crisis about jobs?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right, that was your initial frame, right?
Yes.
And I will tell you, in the biggest economic boom that mankind has ever seen, what we elected to do as a society was build the greatest number of prisons that we ever constructed and locked up the greatest number of people. So, my question is, who is the real boogeyman? You know, because like in the best of times, what we did was we did the worst of things to human beings.
Well, people would say those prisons weren't built just for the sake of building prisons. Those prisons were built to house people who committed crimes.
Well, or future crimes.
Well, they finally put it, I guess the one in Illinois is where they couldn't fill up because I guess they're going to put the shake in there or something.
Yeah, we build them so fast we can't even fill them anymore.
You know, I was in D.C. a couple years ago sitting on a panel interviewing some researchers around prisons and the criminal justice system. And I sat there and I listened. And so the question came to me is, like, what are the researchers missing? And a couple things. First of all, we constantly conclude with the cost factor. And Henrietta, you taught me this on your show. You asked me a question that blew me away one day. You said, David, what is this whole concept in America? It has an addiction to prisons. Being a certified addiction specialist and all that kind of stuff, understand what addiction is. And when it comes to addiction, money doesn't mean nothing. I don't care about no money. So we need to quit concluding with the cost factor of what happens. It's something else, kind of like what Dorsey was saying, a revenge or something. The other thing that I don't think that we realize is the psychological effects of institutionalization. We do not understand that. I've been out of prison 20 years, and if I don't have the psychological means to be able to continue to monitor myself, to be able to teach me different things, to continue for other people to monitor me, with me, I am an accident waiting to happen. So when we're talking about building this thing, this cadre of folks, this community, all of that stuff needs to be taken into effect. How you say her name? Your name, sister? What's your name?
Tandria
talked about services and our systems and cities or whatever that can say, oh, we're providing this, we're doing that, but are we really doing it? I'm the president of an agency that actually provides those services, and the money, the resources that it takes to be able to do that. If I wasn't a real community person and saw people for being human beings and my neighbors, those people wouldn't even be able to get those little services. And I say little services, that they're getting the little $10 hour job, the little temporary housing, the little education, the little stuff. All of that is little compared to what happens to people when they become incarcerated. Then the question comes, is like, well, how long does a person need to be incarcerated before this effect takes place? We don't know. The researchers don't go that place. I went into prison 18 years old, what I considered as having a sprained ankle. I wasn't that bad. When I got out 17 years later, I had a full broken leg. Okay? A full broken leg, and like what Andrea is saying, with $200 to buy me a cane with. That's insane.
Yes, it is insane. And I'd like to go back to this concept of all of us or none of us. And go back to the original question, one of them, why should people care? Now, you talked about the commercialism of our society. Mm-hmm. You talked about how individual people are pitted against one another. Mm-hmm. What do we need to do to push this concept of all of us or none, that we're in this together, and what happens to one of us somehow affects all of us? So what do we do to get the community to be aware of the connectedness and what we need to do that will enable all of us?
I think it's almost, you know, well, it's never too late, but it's a little late for my generation and Dorsey's generation. But that secondhand smoke that we're hearing from that young woman on this damn station is the thing that we need to be hearing. It needs to be revolutionized. We need to quit talking about so much. Oh, the what is it, 100,000 and 200,000 people in prison in California, 40,000. But the effects of that on the community is huge. The millions of children that are born and have to survive through this system because of this stuff needs to be highlighted and magnified, and some kind of evolution to take place to make this thing so that we become aware.
Dorsey?
For me, the community...
Go ahead, Tandria.
For me, the community think has to change. Honestly, it's people's perspectives that have to change. People have to think of things in a different way. And they have to recognize that when these people are locked up and taken away from communities, that it continues to affect the community. It's not just that person. If that person behind is leaving behind children, where are those children going to go? If they go into the foster care system, we as a community, as a state, are paying for that. If they have to go to grandparents, grandparents need help supporting these kids and raising these kids. It affects the community. These kids are coming up without their parents. They're almost having to raise themselves. What do you think that leaves them, and what are they going to do next? It's a generational effect, and people have to think of that. It's not just that person who gets locked up. That person gets pulled away from their kid for 25 years. They leave that kid at 5. By the time they come home, if they're able to come home, the kid is 30. They're not a kid anymore, and they've done all the growing up that they need to do in the 25 years, and they've done it without that parent there. That's going to affect that child, no matter who raised them. So we have to, as a community, we have to look at that, and we have to embrace these families that are being affected by this, but then also embrace those people when they come home and give them community support. That means helping them, giving them training and getting them caught up. When you're out of the loop for 5 years, look at how long it takes for computers to go obsolete. Buy a cell phone today, and I'm going to tell you right now, in 6 months, there's going to be another version you wish you had. I bought my cell phone November of last year. Dorsey has the newer version of my phone this year. You know, and that's just talking about cell phones. So if technology is advancing like that, people who are behind the wall are not advancing with it. So they're coming home behind. They're coming home not having skills that they need. You know, there was a person that, and I won't say the name, but that, you know, we all celebrated coming home. And when she first got home, the first thing Dorsey did, because he went to pick her up, was to put a cell phone in her hand. She didn't want to touch it. She was scared of it. She was afraid of what it would do to her. That's how much things had moved forward in the time that she had been gone.
Dorsey?
But we're throwing her back into society and into our community, expecting her to just be able to keep up and get with it. So as a community, we have to help people get to where they need to be so that they can be independent, so that they can stand on their own. And that means offering real services, not just saying it, but offering those services and making sure that they're working for and with the community. Yeah. And if the community is involved in that, that makes them feel vested in that person coming back and staying on the right path. People start to care then, but they should care about these people coming back into their communities for no other reason but because if you don't help them, what are you leaving them to do?
Steal my television.
Commit more crime. Yeah, Tandria, thank you for that. We got one more minute. Dorsey, can you kind of sum this up?
Yeah, for me, I think that it results in real services and real policy change, and to build a society that change what they expect. Because, like, when I see people coming home from prison, what I generally see is untapped resources that could be used to rebuild our community. And what other people see is something different. So, like, I'm asking them to give themselves a break and actually pay David Lewis to actually provide real services so David won't have to stay up at nighttime figuring out where is he going to get the resources to actually give the meager services that he got. Give David the money. Don't keep throwing the question that we haven't dealt with is suppose all the stuff that we're doing right now in terms of putting people, locking people up, don't work. Do we have the guts to look at it and say it doesn't work? Let's do something different. And maybe we need to get to the question. It doesn't work. Let's do something different. And what we probably should be doing is how to actually incorporate large numbers of people, which we're going to get back anyway, in a different way.
Dorsey, if folks want to get a hold of you and your work, do you got a website they can get a hold of you at?
They can get a hold of me at. I got a website at Legal Services for Prisons with Chuka Children. They can Google that. They can Google
Legal Services
for Prisoners. With prisoners with children, they can Google
dot
that.
Org.
Okay.
Or they can Google all of us
none.org. Okay.
And they will get a hold of our website. But even more importantly, the thing that I ask people to do is to get in touch with your humanity, because we're gonna have 5 million people released within 3 years. What are you going to do and what are you prepared to do to embrace those people in your community for your own safety?
Dorsey, we're completely out of time, but I want to thank you. I want to thank David Lewis. I want to thank Tandria Madison. And I want to thank Henrietta Burroughs for setting this whole thing up. And can we do this show again soon?
But can of we? Course. Of course.
Yeah.
Please.
Yes.
Let's raise these
we'll
issues
all
again.
Be here.
Okay. Thank you very much for tuning in. Stand by for another edition of Raising Sand. And thank you, folks, for coming down. Thank you
thank
for your
you
time.
Thank you so much,
Bert. No problem. Thanks.
Thank you.